Welcome back to Life Coach BFF Show. I'm your host, Heather Petty, and you are just in time for episode number 165 with my guest, Kirsten Lindquist. Over the last 20 years, Kirsten has connected on a personal level with her more than 150 million viewers, QVC, and network news through confident vulnerability and the curated ability to tell a story that makes you feel. She is a board-certified health coach and chief wellness officer. She's a contributor to publications such as Cell Magazine, Vibrant Life, FoxNews.com, and America Adopts. She is the author of two books on faith and wellness and has written three sold-out devotional Bible sets alongside Zondervan at QVC. Kirsten is an Emmy Award-winning journalist. She has her own lifestyle brand of clothing and books that generates over $2.5 million a year on QVC through faith and wellness inspirational messaging. All of it stemming from her own experiences, health, infertility, adoption, familial addiction, grief, and abundant hope. She's the first to tell you her success is not of her. It is all the Lord's work through her. She and her family live on a sunny hill in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Can't wait to get to this conversation. Life Coach BFF Show with me, your friend Heather, because we all need a BFF to take this journey called life with. This is a podcast for midlife women who want to remain sane and find joy. We're living with purpose and determination to get all the goodie out of life because I believe God made the goodie for His people, you and me. So hop aboard this train of intention, come and sit on my porch and rest, or pop in your earbuds and let's take a walk together. I'm just so grateful you're here. Hi, welcome to the show. I am so happy to have you today.
Oh, nice to meet you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. This is going to be a fun time. Tell us what it's like, first of all, to host a show on QVC. I think it's just amazing that you do this.
Well, it is very fun. It is extremely organic. People, one of the first questions they always ask is, do you have a teleprompter? And absolutely not. Nothing is scripted. There's no teleprompter. It really is kind of like this, like just chatting with friends, only we do it for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours at a time and just keep going.
Wow. I know when I watch y'all, it looks like such a fun time, just a non-judgmental atmosphere. That's what I love about it. It's like a group of ladies just getting together and having a good time. First of all, I always think I would love to be there with you because you look like you're having so much fun.
And I think that that's kind of the secret to my success, if I've had any other than the Lord, is I really am just having a good time with friends. I'm very much real. There's no, granted, the job is to sell products for sure.
Right.
But I even walk into the building. I walk into the building and it's a huge building and takes up, you know, like 10 football fields. And I, you know, I walk in going, I enter this place ready to serve. And that's serving the person on the other end of the screen. Because sometimes, a lot of times, she's not shopping. She just wants some company. And she wants to feel like she matters and she exists. And I'm there, up there on TV for 3, 4, 5 hours at a time just to make her feel that. So I think that's part of the secret to my success.
Well, you're definitely doing that. Because once I turn it on, I am hooked. And I'm one of those people that I'm easily sold. And so I want to buy. Y'all make it sound so exciting. I want to buy everything that you talk about. So how many products a week would you say that you end up taking home?
Oh, well, not that much. I mean, when you think about it, I've been there for 13 years. So a lot of the things are, you know, they have their life cycles at QVC. So there's, you know, a lot of the same things. So I don't take home that much. But I would say at least, you know, 3 to 5 products a week will come in that I'll have to take home and test or something like that. I'm also a shopper. I mean, I buy a lot of what I'm presenting. And then I also have my own lines. You know, I have a line of clothing. I do bags. I do jewelry. I do shoes. I do all of those things. So that's all definitely in my world.
Right. So what came first, the hostessing on the show or having your own line?
Hosting.
Okay.
news. I was in news for many, many years. And then I moved over to QVC to hosting. And then after quite a bit of success at QVC, I started getting offers to do collaborations, and they worked really well. The first thing I collaborated on was a cross necklace that was fantastic many, many years ago. And then from there, it was Bibles and journals. And then I went into clothing and shoes and bags. And it's been really nice.
So do you feel like that's how you merged faith into your job at QVC, is through your Bibles and your journals?
I definitely feel like that's one major way I do it. I think organically, again, I can't get up and talk in front of anybody for more than 5 to 10 minutes before the Lord comes into the conversations. It's just that much of a big part of my life. So if I'm talking for hours at a time, it's going to come up because that's who I am. So that just organically is how I've kind of come to known as the one of, if not the Jesus girl at QVC. But also when I am creating products, again, that's what I'm creating for me first and foremost. And what I want is a My Saint, My Hero bracelet that helps and reminds me every time I look at it to say a prayer. And what I want is a good journal. And what I want is a shirt that says Ponder Lovely Things. So that's how my products get created.
Yeah. What about, okay, so your children, do you create products for kids? Because I know they play a huge part in your life. I want to talk more about that in a minute, but have you gotten into that realm?
They really do. I mean, the first piece of clothing I ever created was a sweatshirt that said Faith, Family, Fitness. And those are my three bigs. So wellness space, faith, and my family. So absolutely they're top of the list. But QVC doesn't really do a whole lot for kids. When you think about it, like, our customer is a very savvy woman over the age of 50. And a lot of times that's past the kid stage, you know, great kids, but that's past the kid stage. So we don't do a whole lot in the kid space. So unfortunately, I haven't done that yet.
Okay. But you've thought about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've written a couple of books and I'm writing more. And I have this dream of doing a book with at least one of my daughters who's very into that as well. And then my son was, he's little and he's like, I want to do a book with you, mommy. So maybe that would be a kid's book. But I've always thought about it. Yeah.
When did you become especially strong in your faith? Was there a pivotal point in your life, something that happened that turned you more in that direction than you had been in the past?
I was raised a Christian. My mom gave me Jesus from a very early age. And I was just having this conversation with, I have two 14-year-old daughters right now. And one of them the other day, and I said, you know, I don't think I was the norm in terms of teenager. I went deeper into my faith in high school. I was very, very connected to youth group and Young Life and all of those things. Whereas I think a lot of kids at that age start to question if they've been raised in a Christian household. So I was very, very strong in my faith then. And then high school, I mean, I was still there, but not like, college, I was still there, but not like I was in high school. And then I think as soon as I got out of college, I got married younger than I thought. I got married at 25. I was shocked. I thought I'd always be that woman who waited a long time. And then faith became really, really important again in my marriage, in our struggles with infertility. And then I would say in the last 8 to 10 years since we came here and I've really had this platform to talk more about it, it's become stronger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Infertility, that's a hard road.
It is. Yeah. And it's full of shame and it's full of judgment on yourself and secrecy. All those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's especially difficult, too, when the expectations, societal expectations, are you get married, then you have children. And I don't know about you, but we had one child and then multiple miscarriages, multiple. And people would ask me all the time, we lived in a small town, and they would say, when are you going to have another baby? What's the holdup? And I just wanted to say, I'm trying as hard as I can, and it's not happening. So did you have those moments?
Well, let me ask you a question then. Why didn't you?
I, know why I didn't. I think that it was a fear of being judged. Number one, I was young. I mean, I was like right before I turned 30 at this point. And with miscarriages, I don't know if you experienced that, but that was a terrible time. I mean, it was terrible because your friends are all having babies. You're going to baby showers. You know, you get pregnant. You're all excited. Everybody's celebrating. And then, you know, you miscarry. And so it just, I mean, it was just a terrible time. I just couldn't even talk about it. How about you?
Are you that person, though, who, so you don't necessarily want to share when you're going through a rough time? Or did you feel like you didn't want the reaction of whatever they would say?
Oh, I love this. Look, I haven't talked about this really in years. Can you believe I've been podcasting since 2019, but I've done one episode on this. One.
An important topic. Really, it is.
Very important topic. It's very important.
You didn't want to tell people about it because it was too hard for you to talk about it, or you didn't want to tell people because you were afraid of their reaction.
No, it was too difficult for me to talk about. It really was. I mean, one of the miscarriages was later in my pregnancy. It was just, it was too painful. And all I ever wanted was to be a mom growing up. That's all I ever wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, me too. You know, I had two miscarriages. We had a miscarriage the very first time we got pregnant, which was the only time we ever got pregnant naturally. And then we started infertility treatment about eight or nine months later, and had failed attempt after failed attempt after failed attempt, which often felt like a miscarriage every time you failed at treatments. And then I had a second miscarriage after my first daughter was born. But, you know, I wrote my first book called 5 Months Apart, which is a story of infertility, faith, and grace. And it really does go into that, you know, as humans, as people, what we want more than anything else, what we crave is validation. And this can go back to QVC too, which is why, you know, QVC there is there. You want to feel validated. You want to feel like you matter. You want to be heard. And women, historically, when they go through this very, very defining, difficult time, clam up and don't talk about it and don't say anything. So we're honestly really denying our basic need of what we want. And that wreaks all kinds of havoc on your brain, on your heart, on your health. So we need to be able to talk about it and get it out there and share and understand. Because the second I started talking about infertility on, at the time I was a newscaster for ABC, and I started talking about it on a blog, which blogs were brand new then, it was, as you can imagine, out of the woodwork. Everybody. Yeah. I've never talked about this. I had one. That was the darkest period of my life. But that's how we heal through it.
Oh, absolutely. That's how you heal. I mean, it's all coming back to me because you have to remember my oldest is almost 27. So this has been a long time. This has been since 1999. But I just remember dreading the reactions of the people around me, too, because people, they didn't know what to say. You know, they're all excited for you. When's the baby due? And then you drop this terrible news. And just the facial expressions, you know, then you felt like you needed to make them feel better. And I was excited for my friends who were having babies, so I didn't want to bring them down in the process. But it just, you're right. With when you talk about it, there's a lot of healing in that.
I literally have a section in that first book that says, you know, what to say and what not to say. Like, because that's one of the things, right? If people don't know what to say. Although I have found most actually do because they've been through it. Most of the time, what you're going to say, this happened to me, and you're going to get a, oh my gosh, me too. As opposed to just, you know, there are those people who just don't know what to say. And you got to give them grace. Right. We got to give everybody grace.
Yes. And I mean, I would have reactions like, you know, you have one beautiful child, you know, you should be thankful for this child, which I was so grateful and thankful.
Not, right.
Yes. So I would hear that. I'm sure you've heard all this saying. Yeah. Yes. Or you need to just get on with your life. Don't think about this. I mean, all of those things were said, but yeah, that was, I mean, my heart goes out to any woman who is dealing with that right now in infertility, because when you want a baby, that's all you can think about.
So true. And you get that. And again, my first miscarriage happened. I didn't have any children. It took us years to get pregnant and have a child after that and to adopt. And it was a lot of just relax. Don't think about it. It'll happen. You know, those things, which you're
right.
You're
just... And then with adoption, what would really make me laugh, and that's a whole nother conversation. But while we were waiting, people would say, well, you're probably going to get pregnant while you're waiting on this baby or right after you get this baby. And I had had to have a hysterectomy. So I was thinking there's no,
not really.
No. So at what point did you make the decision to adopt?
Pretty early on. My brother's adopted. My sister-in-law is adopted. So it was on both sides of our family. My cousin's adopted. So pretty early on, we decided that we would adopt whether or not we had our own kids or like biological children. So after about a year and a half, 2 years of infertility treatment, we signed up to go the adoption. But we continued with fertility treatments because I still had some left on my insurance. And so like, might as well. And they weren't working. We'll just do both. So when people say, oh, you'll probably get pregnant as soon as you adopt, I did. But it wasn't because I relaxed and finally got pregnant. It was because I was in the midst of fertility treatments at the same time as we were adopting. And I remember doing some research at the time because I would hear that all the time. Oh, you know, you relaxed and got pregnant. That's why it totally happened. And this is my favorite. I hear that all the time. Everybody who is infertile just adopts and they get pregnant. And I was like, it's very similar to a shark attack. Of course, you're going to hear about it when it happens because it's a shark attack. If you actually look at the data, it rarely happens, right? So, and for me, again, it was similar to you. Like, no, this was all very medical. There was no by chance.
Were people encouraging when you announced that you were going to adopt, or did you not tell people?
Oh, I told everybody. We told everybody everything every step of the way. I really felt, even when I would get pregnant and, you know, miscarry, I really felt like, well, am I keeping this a secret because I don't want to then have to tell them? Well, but are these the same people that I would tell if I had a miscarriage anyway? And I need the support right now because I'm pregnant. So, you know, people are always like, oh, just 3 months, all that kind of stuff. I would never do that. I would tell the people that I was going to tell anyway, right away, because if I were to lose this baby, I would need them when I miscarried. So why don't I just tell them I'm pregnant right now? I didn't keep that so close like a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. But I also am, I'm a huge proponent of talking about it, sharing your story. Sharing your story is one of the best ways for us to heal. So I told everybody everything. And same thing with adopting. Like as soon as we got matched with who, and you know, with adoption, obviously, it can all go wrong. And it does. Very, very, very frequently. But as soon as we got matched and we thought that we were in a good place, that first day, you know, I told lots of people and most responded how I wanted them to. But I think adoption always is one of those things where you will still get those people. Adoption is still to this day, not as much as it was 13 years ago when we adopted our first baby, but it's talked about, oh, he's adopted. Oh, so it's adopted. And I was like, why are you whispering? Because that makes it sound dark and hidden.
Right, right.
And it's not what adoption is. So with our babies, we would, you know, even when they were on the table, like getting their diapers changed, we would be like, you're adopted. And we were always very loud and excited about it because I feel like that's something that needs to be taken out of the shadows. Because as soon as you start to whisper it or talk about it in quiet, it becomes dark and dirty, and that's not what it is.
Right. And I did find myself when our third child was born, I would practice when he was a baby telling him his birth story. And at first, I don't know about you, but I noticed I was very emotional about it.
Oh, every time we talk about any of that with any of my kids, I cry. Always.
Yes. I mean, I would start crying. And then finally, by the time he was three, I could tell the story without crying. It was just, but I still do get teary-eyed at times. I know exactly. There's just, I tell people, if you want to see the face of God, adopt a child. Because he has adopted us. And you can just, you can see, it's funny because So I have a really good friend. People will ask me occasionally, you know, how did you know that you could love a child that you did not birth? And I have a good friend whose husband was killed when she was 9 weeks pregnant. And right after she had the baby, I had my first baby, and she would come and stay with us. And he would wake up early in the morning sometimes, and I would go and get him from her so that she could sleep late, because she just never had that advantage being a single mom. And I would put him in the bed with us, talking about myself and my husband. And I would look at him and I just adored him. And I knew then, I was like, I can love any baby.
Absolutely. People, that's one of the major questions that I always get when I'm counseling women through adoption is, you know, I don't know, will we feel the same about our adopted kids as about biological? And every person is different. I'm a health coach. I use the words all the time, bioindividuality. Everybody is different. But at least from my experience and everybody that I've met who's gone down this path that I've talked to and worked with, you will love that baby, that child as much. If not, it's not a more, it's a different kind of love. Like I feel at least with my firstborn. First of all, she's my firstborn. She's adopted.
Yeah.
Something different about your firstborn, too, about the way that you love your first child, your second child, your third child. Not a more, it's indifferent. Mm-hmm. And with her, there is, you know, she was so hard fought for. My second child was an IVF baby. Not that that wasn't hard, but our adoption story was harder than our IVF story. And it was, you know, when you're a parent who's looked down the barrel of not having a baby and then you have one, no matter if it's birthed or you worked hard with birth parents and you got that baby, you will love that child with an intensity that just cannot be matched. The only thing that I think is different is the parents who had miscarriages, had infertility, all of that, and had kids, and then the ones who just suddenly got pregnant and here we are.
Yeah.
Like, I will go to bat with, I think this category over here has more of a passionate love because they had that fear at some point of maybe never being a parent, whereas this was always a given. This group was always a given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And it's funny when you mentioned that people will question, you know, will I love this baby as much as I would, you know, a biological child? I can remember with our fourth child, and he looks very different than I do, or my husband, but I would look down at him as a newborn, and I would think, you look exactly like me. Did you ever do that?
Well, yeah. And our daughters were born so close together. So they were 5 months apart and they looked very much alike at birth. And absolutely. And everybody would always say that my daughter who was adopted looks like my husband. He's German, but some reason, I guess dark hair, he looks darker. She's Mexican. So people would always say, oh, they look just like each other. Or it cracks me up. It happens all the time. And it even happens with girls who don't look anything alike anymore. And then our third child who's adopted he was born in Philadelphia, but his ancestry is Honduran, and him and my first daughter look exactly alike. And so everybody's like, oh, did you get this baby from the same birth mother? And all of the, it's not at all.
No. And what gets me is people will ask, are they really siblings? And I'll say, yes, they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
You them bite.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mine are like twins. Absolutely. I actually, interestingly enough, with the one daughter that I birthed, our middle child, I actually had a harder time bonding with her than I did with my first baby who was adopted. And I think part of it is like when Grace came out, that was my adopted daughter, my first child. I just felt like I already knew her. I had worked so hard. I was so connected. Like, whereas then when Georgia, who I birthed, came out, it was a rough pregnancy. It was a rough delivery. It was all of this. She didn't look anything like I thought she was going to look like. And I also had this newborn that was like, it was during the time of, it was like hand and foot or
oh, no.
Ow or something weird was happening. And it wasn't COVID, but like all of the hotels, like you couldn't come up, not hotels, hospitals. And I couldn't get to Grace, who was 5 months old at the time. And I remember just being just so distraught because I was so connected to her. And then I had this other newborn baby who kind of didn't really like me because it was a bad birth. And so I actually had a harder time falling in love with the child that came out of me than I did with the one that didn't. I mean, now, obviously, love everybody.
Right. That is so interesting. I have never heard that before. That's really interesting. Well, and what really makes me laugh is so one of our children is half Hispanic, and in the summertime, they get very dark, dark tan. So we'll go places and people will say, they'll look at all of us and they'll say, they'll look at him and go, where did you get this tan from? You know, people, it's
just, they do that with Grace all the time. You're so tan. And we're like, she's Mexican.
That's so funny. I love it. Was there anything that really stood out in your mind during the adoption that you thought this cannot be from anyone else but God? Was there anything that you just went, wow? I mean, I know the whole big picture, of course.
We had a facilitator as opposed to an adoption agency, and they specialize high-risk birth mothers. So we had eight, hospital calls of, would you be interested in being submitted for this baby who's being born right now? And they all were some version of, mom was homeless, or birth mom is probably on drugs. This is a preemie, maybe meth, maybe cerebral palsy. We're not sure. So, and you know, we're 20 nothing kids who just want a baby. And every single time it broke our heart to say, no, we aren't willing to take on a special needs kid right now. I mean, we said eight times, and I remember kept on questioning the Lord. I was like, am I saying no to the baby you want us to have? Like every time this phone rings and they tell me, oh, a baby might be blind. And I say, no, is this the wrong answer? Mm-hmm. But I always felt a peace about it afterwards. You know, granted, I was under a dark cloud for many, many years going through all this process of infertility and adopting. And when we got matched with Grace's birth parents, she was only 4.5, 5 months pregnant. So we were really, really connected through the entire thing, which was a whole nother type of hard. There was so much emotion. She went through a time of being homeless. You want to just adopt the birth mother too. You know, birth father wasn't necessarily. It was just really, really hard. But I always felt like we were doing the right thing. I always felt like every penny we were spending to help her, the birth mother, was exactly where it needed to be. And there was this one moment the birth father had to sign off his rights, and he wasn't really in the picture. And it was hard for us to get him to get his signature. And I remember when they called and told me that that had happened, and I feel like that was the one thing that was keeping me back. And I remember literally falling to my knees in front of the computer when they called, and I was writing some things down, and they said that he had signed. And I just, it was this wash of relief that it's all okay. This is it. And that was the first time, and I was almost 30, about right then. I remember falling to my knees, and that is what had gotten me from then, I'm now 46 years old, to pray religiously on my knees, was that one moment when it was such a release from my body, because I was so nervous and so scared. And one phone call came in and the Lord just sent me to my knees, that kind of changed the trajectory of my life and how I pray and how I relate to the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really focus with the first adoption, well, with both situations, on that verse in Hebrews, faith is believing in what we hope for and what we cannot see. What we cannot see, but now I can't remember how the verse goes.
But we all know what you're talking about, though.
Yeah, to be able to just spout it right out, but I can't. Now it's not coming to me. But anyway, I really focused on that verse because, you know, I just, you don't know what's coming, but you know that if it's from God, it's going to be good. You know that.
Yeah. I always say that his plan is better than ours.
Yes.
It really is. And he's not always going to show it to you. And oftentimes he's not. And oftentimes he's going to say, you have to trust me first, and then I'll open the doors along the way. But you have to take that first step of faith. And the reason that he wants us to do that is because if we see all the steps ahead of us and we're in control of it, we're not relying on him as much as we need to. And if you're taking a blind step of faith, you really have to have somebody to hold on to. And that's what he wants. Being close communion with him.
Yes. And I mean, it is so powerful when you do that, when you just release that control and you turn it over to him. It is the most powerful feeling.
It is.
Well, I'm switching gears on you, but I want to talk about your book. And the title of this book is Where's My Crown for Acting Like Everything is Fine? I love this title.
Yeah, that royally surviving life's waiting periods is what it's all about.
Yes, because just like you were asking me, what held me back from really talking about the miscarriages at the time, you know, how I think we all go through times where we're just balancing that crown and trying to pretend like everything's okay.
Right. And it had so many different meanings to me as well, because, you know, we are called royalty in the Bible. We are daughters of the king. We are kings and queens and princesses and princes ourselves. So we have to remember that. But also, we all just need to get awards for what we're managing.
Yes, yes. So how do you manage all, you have your own product lines, you're on QVC, you're an author, you're a speaker. How are you juggling all of this?
Well, really, it's very intricately entwined with faith and wellness. And that I like to pull health science and then biblical truths and put them together. And that's really where my entire platform comes from. That book is all about how you survive life's waiting periods. I always put it this way. You're in a waiting room. Let's say you have a diagnosis that you're waiting for. Like, you know, you've had an MRI and you're waiting that week to figure out what happened. Let's just take that as an option. And you're waiting and you're waiting and you're freaking out and you're worried. And you're like, if I could just get to the results where it says everything's fine, if I could just get to that, you're in that waiting room. I could just open that door and get to the other side of whatever that is. If I could get that job, if I could get that spouse, if I could, whatever you're waiting for, right? And what God is telling us is that he has you in that waiting period, in that waiting room for a very specific reason. And it might be because it's to grow you to be more dependent on him. He wants you to be quiet and spend time with him. It might be because there's somebody else in that waiting room that you need to talk to. You need to open your mouth and tell him what you're going through and share that, share your story so that you can be vulnerable together. He might need you to decorate that room and make it a little bit prettier for the next person who's going to be in there because you're serving them. He's giving you tools in that waiting room, because what happens is when you get to that, oh, the diagnosis comes in, or, oh, I meet that person and you open the door, what's on the other side is another waiting room. You will go into another time of waiting because life is a series of waiting. So I give in this book tangible ways for you to survive in that waiting room. And a lot of that has to do with how you take care of yourself. It's how you pray. It's how you have a communion with the Lord. It goes back to the four key components of wellness: how you sleep, how you move, how you eat, and your relationships and your spirituality. And if you can work on those four things while you're in your wait, you will thrive and not be so insistent on getting out of the waiting room and getting to the next wait.
Yeah, that is so well said, Kirsten. I've never heard anybody explain it quite like that, but that was so well said.
Yeah.
Because we're all in a waiting room all the time.
You always are. And it might be a big wait. It might be a big wait like cancer. It might be a big wait like you know, you're 42 years old and you still haven't met your person. Like these are big wait, or for a baby. You know, you and I both went through that. You know, you're waiting. That's a huge wait. It could be a small wait. It could be a job. It could be just a seasonal affective disorder. You're in a series of being blue. It could be smaller waits as well, but you're always going to be waiting. And unfortunately, fortunately, our Lord is going to continue to allow us to get into these series of waits. And it's going to be harder for us if we don't really take the time to learn what we need in that, to make the next one easier.
Mm-hmm. You've got to stop and learn the lessons.
You do. And stop. For me, a lot of that for me has always been managing worry and stress and fear, and managing my desire to control. God's always trying to work on that. Managing my relationship with money, because I have this big dependence on this very much. This, I come from lack. There's never going to be enough. I'm never going to be able to survive. All that. So God, I find in all of my weights, God's still grooming me, still teaching me. And, you know, even as somebody who professionally talks about wellness and sales and health and all of that, no matter what you do, it's always a practice. You're never perfect.
Yeah.
No Christian is perfect. No executive is perfect. It's always a practice.
Mm-hmm. That is so true. That's so good. You're exactly right. Well, I know that my listeners are going to want to stay in touch with you. And how can we connect with you?
Best place to go is my website, Kirsten-Lindquist. And then it's also Kirsten Lindquist on all the platforms. So Instagram, Facebook. I do a little bit of TikTok and things like that as well. I have a blog there on my website. I'm most active on Instagram, though. That's where you get most of my daily stuff.
You are so much fun, Kirsten. I could just spend all afternoon with you. You are a delightful person, and I cannot thank you enough for being here.
It was totally my pleasure. You're so kind, and I love how much we have in common. It was wonderful to talk to you.
I do too. I've enjoyed this. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It has been delightful. This conversation just filled my heart, filled my cup, filled my soul. I'm so happy to spend this time here with you. I love you. Jesus loves you even more. Thanks again for joining me. If you haven't already subscribed to this channel, please do so right here or click the plus button in your podcast. Have a quick disclaimer from our legal team. I am a coach, not a therapist. Always seek the support of a therapist for clinical mental health issues. See you next time.